Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Audio bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by Winamp. Subscribe to TWiT and all your favorite podcasts with the ultimate media player. Download it for free at winamp.com. Video bandwidth for TWiT is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, episode 269, recorded October 10th, 2010. Foul Play. This Week in Tech is brought to you by GoToMeeting. Reduce costs, improve efficiencies, and help your company's bottom line with GoToMeeting. For your free 30-day trial, visit GoToMeeting.com/TWIT. And by Ford and voice-activated Sync, featuring true hands-free calling, turn-by-turn directions, 911 assist, and more. Available exclusively on Ford, Lincoln, and Mercury vehicles. For more details, visit SyncMyRidePodcast.com. And by Audible.com. Sign up for the Platinum Plan and get 2 free books. Go to audible.com/twit2. And don't forget to follow Audible on Twitter. User ID audible_com. It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech, the show that covers the week's tech news. Joining us this week, as I go around the table, a nice cast of very talented people, including somebody who hasn't been on TWiT in a while, but is here to celebrate 10-10-10, John Graham Cumming of JGC.org, the author of The Geek Atlas. Hi, John.
Hi, how you doing, Leo?
Coming to us all the way from the UK. Where in England are you?
I'm in a basement, of course, and I'm in London.
In basement England. I'm surprised there isn't a town in England named In the Basement.
You wouldn't surprise me if there was.
The Basement on Avon.
It wouldn't be pronounced like that.
Right. It's pronounced Derbyshire. Also with us, John C. Dvorak in a lovely shirt that connotes...
commemorative.
Fine dining. What is...
It's a commemorative Hawaiian shirt, the kind you used to wear.
I would if I had...
On the old screensaver show before the suits told you to stop it.
Yeah. I asked them once if I could wear bowling shirts. They said it was too down market. So I was wearing Hawaiian shirts, and then they said, stop it. Commemorating what?
What?
That shirt.
Commemorating the loss of the Hawaiian shirt to this show.
Oh.
I don't know.
What does it mean? It's got food, wine, sushi?
Yeah, it's one of those Jams World shirts that people like to collect. It's just got a bunch of designs on it.
I like it.
It's like wearing art.
Okay. Some might call it that. Also here with us, I'm so glad to have him, Tom Merritt. He hasn't been on. I've been very careful and protective of his time because, of course, he's our day-by-day host of our tech news show, Tech News Today. Hey, Tom.
Hey, Leo. How's it going?
Since we acquired Tom in a trade in June for a player to be named later, he has not been on TWiT. So this is your first time.
That's right, because the last TWiT I did was the day before I started, or
right.
2 days before I started.
And it really is a case of me trying to protect the franchise. I don't want anybody to think that TNT is TWiT.
Or vice versa.
Or vice versa. And, well, I don't mind the other way around, but this is your day off. So thank you for being here.
Yeah, though I was going to come up to the cottage, but then I was doing podcasts all morning and ran out of time.
On your big day off.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for being here. And finally, last but certainly not least, from Gadget, GDGT.com, Ryan Block is here. And the reason I wanted to have you on, Ryan, actually there's so much I could talk to you about, the launch of the Google TV and so forth. But you did a fairly big deal article this week. You're calling it Glassgate. About the iPhone 4.
That's I certainly did use that. It was kind of tongue in cheek. But
too late.
Late. No, that's certainly the shorthand I think that's going to stick. If nothing else.
Let me recap. Apple sells actually at this time in their stores but one iPhone case. It's their own bumper case, which doesn't in any way cover the front or the back. It's just a plastic rim that goes around the case.
Right.
It has one chief merit, which is that it fixes the antenna problem. And I guess if you dropped it on the edge, it might protect it, but it's really, it's about as minimalist as a case as you can get. I use, in fact, I'll show you what I've been using up till I read your article, a case that I bought from the AT&T store from a company called iFrogs with a Z. It's a slip-on case that covers the back, and I kind of like the idea because it protects the back. Well, apparently that's not what's happening. Tell us what's going on, Ryan.
Well, how far back in time do you want me to go? I mean, is it worth kind of getting into how Apple's whole system of selling stuff works?
Yeah, sure.
So some people who've been in the industry have kind of seen this system for a very long time, and not very many other companies outside of the gaming world tend to do this, but Apple does. Way back in the day, I think it was 2003, 2002, when the iPod was first starting to take off, they created a made-for-iPod program. Mm-hmm. And what that meant was they would license third-party iPod accessories.
Right.
And a licensed accessory meant that you got access to Apple's CAD schematics for the devices, sometimes in advance of launch, so you could have the accessories ready.
And you'd get logoed. And Microsoft does this with made for Windows too, with software.
Yeah, they do. They do that. It's something you see a lot more in like the gaming world, right? Like licensed accessories.
Right.
But Apple started doing this, and so they had made for iPod, and then when the iPhone came out and the iPad came out, they did made for iPhone and made for iPad, and now the program is called MFI, made for i, whatever. And it's actually a really cool program for them because, you know, they don't have to go through the work of creating a whole line of accessories, but they get to take basically a chunk of profit from anybody who creates an Apple accessory and gets the license. Gets the Apple license. And then if Apple really likes your accessory, they're going to carry it in the store. And that is, then they're taking both the license fee for the accessory as well as some of the margin off of the actual, you know, cost of the sale. So Apple kind of double dips on it. But most accessories companies really like this because they make less money, but they sell more units.
Yeah, so if you think about it, getting in the Apple store is a huge retail opportunity.
Absolutely. It is. If you make Apple accessories, there's nothing you want more than to be in the Apple store, even despite the fact that Apple is double dipping on your profits. And so where, you know, my whole story with the iPhone cases comes in is if you look at what cases have become available on the Apple Store this week, and there were no cases available for the last couple of months, and now cases are just starting to become available right around the same time I published this story. You'll notice that there are no slide-on cases. And actually, I might have an example. I don't have one handy right now, but it's any kind of case where, you know, you put the iPhone into it and it slides in. And basically what I'd heard.
So this is an example of such a case. This is and I bought this at the AT&T store. This is the iFrogs. So it slides on here and then the bottom slides on there. And, you know, frankly, this is what I've been using. It does the same thing as the bumper case, but it also protects the back.
Right.
And there's I also have a Mophie Juice Pack Air. Does the same thing. Slides on.
Yeah. So there are a lot of cases that do this, and some of them are actually licensed. Like the Juice Pack Air, I think, is licensed, and I think the Duracell one is a licensed accessory. But Apple is not selling them, and Apple does sell the Juice Pack Air for other products as well, and they sell slide-on cases for their other iPhones, for the 3G and the 3GS.
But not for the 4.
But not for the 4, and there's a reason why. But before I get to that, I mean, when you look at the other cases, you see that they don't have, the other ones don't have this mechanism where it slides onto the phone. They have, some kind of mechanism where it snaps on, or in the case of the bumper, it goes on the edge of the phone,
right,
and kind of flips onto place.
Right.
And the reason being what I heard from a source who's given me very reliable information from Apple for many years, and then which I also confirmed from a very large third-party accessories manufacturer independently, was that Apple has kind of gone into lockdown. And right after AntennaGate, they were basically looking for issues. They were trying to find anything else that could blow up in their face.
We don't need another hit on this platform, in other words.
Right.
We don't want to give Consumer Reports any more ammunition.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And what they discovered was the slide-on cases, if there's grit or any kind of matter in between the back of the case and the case as it's sliding on, the back of the phone and the case as it's sliding on, it can scratch and score the glass, which can turn into a fracture or a crack.
So this iFrog's case has some velveteen in there that, but I mean, you could still get some gravel in there. I mean, I don't know how you would, but you could. So what you're saying is really more than just the case, is that if this so-called Gorilla Glass back is scored, that might be sufficient to turn into a fracture on the back.
Right. I mean, it's glass. It's a toughened glass. It's not Gorilla Glass. Gorilla Glass
That's
is made by Corning.
Right.
But it is a strengthened composite glass, very similar to Gorilla Glass. But it's stronger
than the front, though, isn't it? The back?
No, I believe they're actually the same material, the same kind of glass.
Interesting. Okay.
But they, you know, it's glass, and it scores, and it cracks, and it shatters. And
what's interesting to me about this?
What?
I've never heard of such a thing as scratches on any of these devices.
You're being facetious. In fact, this was a big problem. Apple got sued because the iPod was so easy to scratch, one of the iPod models. But this is more important than just a scratch. This is not merely cosmetic, because if it fractures, you could have a break. Is that what you're talking about, Ryan?
Yeah, I mean, when they do fracture, it's not like all the glass comes apart. I mean, it's kind of like the safety glass in a car,
right?
Where if it sustains like an acute impact, it's not all just going to fall out, right? I mean, it does hold together, but you will wind up with you will not necessarily wind up with a fractured back. But if you do wind up with a fractured back, it's going to be it's going to look like a piece of shattered glass on the back. Hmm. And so what Apple is concerned about is basically that you would buy a case, and Apple had licensed some slide-on third-party cases, that you would buy a slide-on case, you would put it on. And, you're a diligent customer. You want to take care of your phone. You want to put it in a case. So you buy the Apple license case from, potentially the Apple store. It could be somewhere else. And then, maybe a month later, you take it off and you find that your phone, which you've taken great care of, has a big crack on the back.
Yeah.
So what Apple did was they kind of went into lockdown on this.
What does that mean when you say went into lockdown?
So they started a test lab specifically for testing this, and they started investigating this very thoroughly, and then they also basically completely wiped the store clear of any slide-on cases.
So that's the proof of this is that you couldn't buy a slide-on. You still to this
you
day
cannot buy a slide-on case.
Can't buy a slide-on case just for the
not
Ford.
From Apple. You can buy them, and they're out there,
right?
And I'm sure that this concerns them, but you cannot buy a slide-on case right now from Apple.
Now I guess the online store is selling. Is the online store selling some? Because
the online store just this week, I think actually the day before I published this story, just put their cases back online. And the funny thing about this story is that I'd been sitting on it for a couple of weeks, and I've been talking to people and trying to build the evidence I thought that was necessary to publish this with the requisite credibility, because Apple stories are obviously subject to a lot of scrutiny. And I reached out to Apple and asked for a comment, and their store had zero cases. Right, no iPhone cases for weeks. And then in the time that I did that, and about 36 hours later, when I published the story, a bunch of iPhone cases went back up on the site.
You think this is in response to you?
I don't necessarily think that it's in response, but it was pretty funny timing, because, I happen to have reached out. And granted, I reached out in early October. I mean, I had expected them to put some of these cases back online anyway, because the free case program ended on September 30th. But it was just very, very bizarre timing. And, it actually, I think, kind of worked in my favor, because, like you said, you go to look at the accessories that they sell, there's no slide-on cases. And there are slide-on cases for the iPhone 3G and 3GS, and there are all kinds of slide-on accessories for those phones. And we also know, of course, that you can buy slide-on accessories for the iPhone 4, but Apple is not selling any of them. They're completely off the site.
Well, why would they put it back on the website? Is it if they're dangerous, why are they selling this spec case?
Well, so the cases that they are selling on the site right now are not slide-ons. They're the snap-ons.
Okay.
So the core of the issue
is still that can't buy a slide-on case anywhere from Apple.
Exactly. The core of the issue is if there's like some grit on the back of the phone or inside the case, which definitely does happen,
scratches
that it's the sliding motion that scratches it and begins the fracture.
Right. So you published this in GDGT a few days ago. What's the response been from your readers? Have they confirmed this, or is this not very likely?
Well, one of the things that I put out there, and I tried to be really clear about this, is that it's preemptive. I don't think that this is a massive, you know, epidemic issue right now. And I think that most people would probably agree with that. And I think that that's in large part to Apple trying to contain this as quickly and as early as possible. I think that if everybody out there was getting, and you also notice that in the free case program, there were no slide-on cases. They were all snap-on cases. I think that if there were tens or hundreds of thousands of slide-on cases out there, that this might be a bigger deal. But Apple, I think, is doing everything they can to prevent that from happening. So, you know, I think they're doing their job. I mean, they're doing a good job at containing this. And, you know, my goal here was not to try to scare people into buying cases or something like that, or not buying cases, but really just to inform people as to what's going on behind the scenes.
Very interesting. So if you have a slide-on case, which I do, is your recommendation to retire it?
You know what I actually did? I have a slide-on case that I've been using for a little while.
I haven't had any problems with it yet, but...
Yeah, what I would recommend is if you have a screen protector, put the screen protector on the back of the phone.
Right.
In between the phone and the slide-on case, and that should help.
Okay.
That would be my first recommendation.
GDGT.com if you want to read more on this story, and there's about 84 comments in there. Some people have had this problem, some have not. The fact that anybody has seems like, you're right, you put a case on it to protect it. If it's going to scratch it, that's not such a good thing, and if it's going to fracture it, that's really not a good thing. Thank you, Ryan.
Thanks.
Ryan Block, GDGT.com. We're going to take a little break, come back with more. John C. Dvorak is here, Tom Merritt, and John Graham coming. We're going to talk a little bit about the analytic engine of Charles Babbage, a big anniversary today. Before we do that, though, I'd like to mention our friends at Citrix who do the fabulous GoToMeeting. GoToMeeting reduces costs, improves efficiencies, makes your meetings come alive. It's the best web conferencing solution by far, and if you haven't tried it yet, I want to give you a free 30 days to try it at gotomeeting.com/twit. It's the easiest to use, easiest to install. Your attendees don't even have to have it installed ahead of time. This is one of the things Citrix does so well. You send them a link in an email, or you can even be on a conference call and say, hey, you know, this is ridiculous. Why don't I just show you what I'm talking about? You tell your conferees to go to gotomeeting.com. You give them the meeting ID. They enter that. There's a little download, a little stub of a download. It's going to take about 30 seconds, and boom, they are now seeing your computer screen on their computer. They can share their screen with you. You can have up to 15 attendees. It's great for product reviews, for sales presentations, training sessions, collaboration, just taking a conference call from a boring old phone call to something exciting and visual. We use it all the time here at the Twit. We have several accounts because we're constantly using this. I want you to try it free. 30 days. GoToMeeting.com/Twit. We thank the folks at Citrix for their support of This Week in Tech. John, I don't know why John does that, but he likes to cover up the screen when we're doing a commercial. Are you embarrassed to be associated with a money-making enterprise? Is that it, John?
No, if I leave to go baste my meat, I don't want people spying on the room.
Who knows what they might see? I'm sorry Ryan couldn't stick around because there's actually some really interesting stuff going on this week.
Why couldn't he stick around? He could have stuck around.
No, he can't. He couldn't. But I thought,
why?
I don't know. He had to baste his meat. I don't know. But he had something else to do. He very kindly agreed to come on. Before we move on, I guess... I take it, just watching the chat room, you had some skepticism about this whole thing.
No, I didn't. But let me just say this. I think you should have at least invited him to stay.
No, I did. We invited him to stay before the show, and he said he couldn't. And I said, can you please come on for 5 minutes and at least talk about this? Because it was a big story. So he agreed to take some time. It's Sunday. He's probably watching the ball game.
By the way, what you want to watch, you don't want to watch any ball games. You want to watch the Red Zone.
I know. This is the DirecTV thing, huh?
No, it's on Dish Network, too.
Dish has it, too.
Oh, yeah.
I have to say, I'm tempted to get a Dish. a dish because of this Google TV? Because it's the only DVR that works with the Google TV.
The Dish Network dish?
Yeah, the TV.
They're building it into the set-top box,
Tom. So the DVR that comes with a dish is supported on the Logitech review.
Oh, cool.
So you... so that if you have, you can say in your Android phone, your iPhone, you can say Hawaii 5.0. And it will not only find Hawaii 5.0 on your program guide, on the internet, if you can watch it on the internet, on various stores, but it will also, if you have DVR recordings of Hawaii 5.0, it will find it there as well.
But now, that's not a feature.
That's not
a feature. Have you ever seen that show?
Yes.
I agree. John has a point. Why would you want that? All right. All righty. Should we move on to another story, or should we go on about this? Anybody have anything to say about this iPhone case thing?
Well, I was watching the chat room, and the chat room was going crazy about how this was not a story.
Isn't that interesting?
I think the blogosphere has echoed it a little stronger than it probably deserves, but I think it's worth paying attention to. If you have one of these cases like you do, Leo, you should know, like, hey, there's a risk of breaking in there. I do agree that I don't think it's a big controversy that Apple is going to, have to come out with another press conference and it's going to kill iPhone sales or anything like that. I think it's just kind of more of a consumer awareness issue.
Yes. Well, we certainly gave it we led with it. So maybe their problem is, and I only led with it because
you couldn't keep Ryan on the whole
Ryan
show.
Ryan had to go.
No. He's good on this regular show.
I mean, Ryan. Ryan's great. He does a show on GDGT, and I would have loved to have kept him. He'll be back. We'll have him back next week or next time he's available. Next time there's not a big game or he's not watching the Red Zone or whatever. The Red Zone is I read somewhere that if you actually time it out, there's only about 4 minutes of action in an NFL game. Literally.
That's why the Red Zone's so good.
And it's not even all the action, just the stuff within the 20 yards of the end zone. Is that it? John Graham are you very confused by all of this?
That's the main idea, is that they just show you what's going on in the Red Zone on all the games at the same time. But they'll show you other stuff. Like if somebody throws a long bomb or something, it doesn't make it to the Red Zone, they'll still show it.
John, in the UK, do they have something similar for cricket matches or anything?
Actually, I was thinking exactly that, which is that cricket, of course, is completely the opposite. It takes about 3 weeks to play and involves having cups of tea every few hours. So the contrast couldn't be greater.
I don't even know how they score. It's six ups and four outs and 10 runs. And there's a variety of numbers. And I don't know what number has to be the highest for you to actually win a game.
Well, actually, almost nobody knows that. I think what actually happens is at the end of it, they decide who had the best tee, and then that's the one who wins the game.
Ah, now I understand. It's like that game in the Fantastic Mr. Fox, Whack Bat, which actually reminded me a lot of cricket. Yeah.
So I have a question, Leo.
Yes, John.
Are we going to get to any news stories today?
Yeah, we've already
covered. Just wondering. It's not like I'm complaining.
Who brought up the Red Zone?
Yeah, good. Thank you, Tom Merritt. Defending me, defending my honor.
Hey, touche, Mr. Merritt.
Yoo-hoo. So, you want to talk about Google Cars?
These self-driving cars are pretty cool.
Autonomous vehicles. Article in the New York Times. Google Cars drive themselves in traffic. I wonder if there's an ice cream truck with Eric Schmidt not driving. The idea behind this, Dmitry Dolgov is a Google engineer. I just do it because I can do a Russian accent.
Google Goff.
He's a Google Goff. He's driving. Well, no, I guess they put an engineer in there just in case it crashes.
Well, to make it legal, to make it street legal.
Wheel, that would be funnier.
But if there's...
Just put a dog behind the wheel.
Yeah, that's right. Have an engineer. So, if you're I've driven Highway 1 between San Francisco and Los Angeles. It is a twisty, crazy, scary road. And if I were to see a Toyota Prius with a curious funnel-like cylinder on the roof and no one at the wheel, I think I would freak out.
Well, they have to put somebody at the wheel. So that's why nobody was freaking out, because they couldn't tell he wasn't driving it. Okay. But to actually make it street legal, they did some look at the rules of the road in California and found out that you can have automatic systems as long as there's somebody there monitoring them. So they had an engineer who could turn off the automatic driving by hitting the brake pedal, by speaking a word in one other way. And they said they only had to actually do that, you know, half a dozen times on this long trip.
1,000 miles these cars have driven without a driver. The rotating cone on the top is called LIDAR. It's a sensor on the roof that scans more than 200 feet in all directions to generate... lying radar! To generate a precise three-dimensional map of the car's surroundings. It then has 4 automotive radar sensors, 3 in front and 1 in the back, to determine the positions of distant objects. It has a position estimator, a sensor on the left rear wheel, which measures movements made by the car. I guess it's giving you kind of a dead reckoning. There's also a video camera in the front windshield near the rear view mirror that's detecting traffic lights. So there, and then there's computers.
And all this for less than $250,000. I want one.
It says 7 test cars have driven 1,000 miles without human intervention and more than 140,000 miles with only occasional human control. They even went down Lombard Street, which is the twistiest street in the world in San Francisco. The only accident was when one car was rear-ended while stopped at a traffic light. It wasn't even the car's fault.
And they also said a lot of the time when they had to...
Go ahead, Tom.
I would say a couple of the times when they had to take control was because a bicyclist actually ran a red light in front of them, and it was harder for the car to see that.
Which reminds me,
yes,
bicyclists are doing this all the time. Why aren't they stopped and cited?
They would be if the cops saw them. And at least in California, a bicyclist has to obey the same rules of the road that a car does, including stop signs and red lights.
Never seen it.
Well, that'll be solved by the Google cars, which will just run straight into them and
kill them all. That's right. It's Darwinian. So what were you going to say, John, about these Google cars?
I actually was wondering if they can drive on the left.
Oh, you know, it's that kind of thing. You're right. Probably nobody's really thought about it. Yeah.
I actually have a funny story about this, which is I met the guy who ran one of the DARPA challenge projects, the Stanford racing one that won it, that went through the desert at Nevada, called Sven Stroband. And he told me that the way they ensured software quality was when a software engineer said, "My module is ready," he said, "Great, we'll put you in the car." And so basically, they had to go in the car for
How ready are you?
And he said, no one ever failed to say, "You know, I could do with an extra week."
Yeah. We'll strap you to the bumper of the car. How about that?
Yeah.
So this is you know, look, this is not technology that's going to be on the roads of the U.S. in the next few years, but it's something we've been talking about for a long time. And in the theory of autonomous vehicles is they would be safer because a lot of accidents are human error. Yes.
Yeah, it's funny you brought up Stanford, John, because one of the guys that oversaw Stanley, the DARPA car that did this, is one of the guys that's doing this for Google on contract. And it's kind of a surprising leap to hear that we went from a total failure, the first DARPA Grand Challenge, to a successful yet very, you know, restricted test. To somebody taking a car just out on the public street and having it drive itself. I mean, it's expensive. It's far ahead. But this could save thousands and thousands of lives and save a bunch of time, too, if it actually works.
I remember talking, I wish I could remember his name, to a researcher in this autonomous car thing. And he had this amazing kind of vision, not only of a safety, but of efficiency. Imagine, he said, that no one owns a car. But that it's kind of like the Zipcar idea, that when you need a car, one arrives. and that, for instance, you order a car arrives, takes you to where you're going, and then disappears. And let's say you need an RV. Instead of buying an RV, you take the car to where you're going, and an RV is already waiting for you there. You get in the RV, you sleep, you spend the night, whatever, and then you go on. In other words, it's just-in-time cars. And he said this would save us a lot of fuel, of time, of efficiency.
So, So, Leo, you're telling me you lost your Ford sponsorship?
No. I think Ford...
Well, then why are you promoting such an idea?
Ford is right in the forefront of this, as a matter of fact. Well, you saw the YouTube video of me crashing my Explorer. Actually, it was a Flex. I was in a Ford Flex. It was on the Ford test track. I think I was wearing a helmet at the time. And they wanted to show me the auto park feature, which is, you know, I asked these guys. I said, of course we can do this in a much grander scale. But in fact, I asked Alan Mulally, the CEO of Ford. He says, people like to drive. So we're not going to take the wheel out of their hands.
And by the way, I want to tell people out there, because I don't think a lot of people know this, but Leo actually drives around all the time with a helmet. It's weird.
I'm required to by state law.
He walks around with it, too.
Yeah. Well, that was after the injury I had to. Because I have this is not commonly known, but you know the fontanelle that children have? Babies have where there's a soft spot where their brain is exposed and it closes up as you grow. Mine never did. So
never went away.
If I were to be struck right here on my head.
Don't push.
Or even to push, I would black out. And if you struck me hard enough, my brain would turn to jelly.
It's like an Achilles heel on your head.
Exactly.
You just gave away your kryptonite right there.
That is my kryptonite. It's the only way I can be stopped. Jason Calacanis is making notes right now.
He's drilling a hole in his head, as a matter of fact.
So this is the 173rd annual anniversary of the invention of the analytical machine. And this man knows a little bit about it because he wrote the Geek Atlas, which includes, places to go for geeks around the world, including the Babbage's, what is it, his house, the analytical machine itself? What can we see?
So let me set you right on one thing. It's not a very wonderful anniversary today. The real point is that no one built Babbage's computer.
There is no analytical machine. It was never made.
It was never made, although bits of it were made. And so what I'm trying to do is build it, and which is quite a large machine. It's about the size of a small truck. And so I started a project to do the research necessary to finish it. And it'll have about 1.7K of memory, made out of brass, essentially, and powered by a steam engine.
Now, what is the difference between the analytical engine and the difference engine? Is that just two words for the same thing, or are they two different things?
So the difference engine, just basically what it does is it calculates polynomials. So it's a calculator. It does one thing. The analytical engine is a programmable computer. It had memory, actually quite expandable memory. At some points, Babbage thought he might need up to 20K of memory. It has a CPU, which is separate from the memory, whereas the difference engine, it's all mixed together. And it was programmed using punch cards. So it was very similar. And it even has microcode, like in a modern microprocessor.
Wow.
And even actually, most amazingly, it has instruction pipelining like in a RISC processor. Just the whole thing is completely mechanical.
And John,
Babbage laid a lot of plans. Yeah.
This is a good kind of fascinates me. I by the way, and I hope you actually do this, but have you thought about the history insofar as why nobody has actually tried to build one of these before? Because we have a lot of billionaires that are techie nerds out there that have got more than enough money to finance something like this, and they could have done it 20 years ago. And has there been any attempts, or is there a history behind this? Because it's always baffled me that nobody's tried to or has actually built one by now.
So I hope the billionaires are listening, because I need about $1 million.
Is that expensive? Wow.
Well, it'll be expensive for one really big reason, which is we built Babbage's difference engine. There's a copy in the Computer History Museum in Mountain View, because Babbage laid out complete plans. So it was possible to just go get the plans out of the Science Museum in London and essentially build it. The analytical engine, much like with any other computer, he kept improving it. So there's a whole load of plans. And every now and then he optimizes some bit of it, making multiplication faster or addition pipelining, all these things. So there's not one definitive set. And I think the big reason people haven't built it yet is there's actually a research project to do, which is to say, all right, look, what of these plans actually constitutes the analytical engine? And once you do that, then you can decide to build it.
So this is the difference engine. This was the source of my confusion. I didn't realize there was a difference. I've seen this. This is local.
Yeah. Yeah, so basically in the late 80s, the Science Museum in London built the Difference engine.
It's all cogs and brass wheels. I mean, it's beautiful.
Yes, it's absolutely beautiful. And the point of doing that was to show that, first of all, Babbage's machines would have worked, and also that the technology available to the Victorians was good enough, because they built this to the tolerances that were available in Victorian Britain with alloys that were available. So the point is that took away all of the uncertainty about whether Babbage's machines could have been built. And so now what we want to do is say, okay, let's decide what the analytical engine was and let's build it and then let's program it.
So this is just a big calculator. You're talking about building the first computer, really.
Yes. It is a general purpose, Turing complete. It has loops. It has all the things you'd recognize in a computer. It has a printer. And for graphical output, it has a plotter.
Wow.
And it runs on a crank then? Difference engine? Steam, yeah, okay. No, there's no electricity in it. It's
No.
Yeah.
No, there's no evidence actually that Babbage ever considered using electricity for any of his computers. He was a contemporary of Faraday, so there was work going on with electricity at the time. But he was completely thinking about mechanical devices powered by steam. The most fascinating thing for me is he believed that in his lifetime it wouldn't be built because essentially he was working alone. And he nevertheless wrote that one day someone's going to build one of these analytical engines, i.e. a computer, and it's going to shape the course of science forever. Wow. And I think that's quite amazing. He was sitting there in 1847 saying, you know, once this is built, it's all going to change. I can see it coming.
Who was Charles Babbage? I mean, how did he get this vision?
He was a mathematician. He was fairly wealthy because his father was a banker and he inherited a lot of money. He was a minor aristocracy in Britain. And so he was Lucasian professor of mathematics at Cambridge. He was a very good mathematician. And he got the idea because at the time it was necessary to print books of tables, log tables. Some of you are old enough to remember
tables. Yeah.
And they were full of inaccuracies because people would make mistakes. And Babbage said, all this ought to be done by steam. Everything from the calculation to the printing. So there's no room for error. And he built that. That machine is the Difference engine, which you can see in Mountain View. The printer even does text justification. So, I mean, go look at it because it's stunning. But while he was working on this, he said, actually, I think there's more I can do if I can get feedback in the system. And the feedback is what led him to the computer, and that's what led him to the analytical engine.
Now, how did Ada Lovelace get involved in this?
So she was, of course, Lord Byron's daughter. Well, one of his children, the legitimate one, at least. And she had some mathematical training. Babbage, because he was a member of high society in Britain, had parties at his house where he would demonstrate bits of the Difference engine. So he really was a nerd, in my opinion.
No kidding.
Look. Can you imagine being invited around to his house with the Duke of Wellington, Sir Robert Peel, Prince Albert? Let's turn this. And in fact, the bit that he demonstrated is in the Science Museum in London. And every time I go and look at it, I think, this is what the guy showed at parties. Luckily, he was wealthy enough that people came. Ada Lovelace was one of those people. She became fascinated by the analytical engine. And she translated a paper, the only really good paper that was published at the time, which was published in French. She translated it into English. And that's really where we get her name associated with it, because she added to that paper pages of notes from her own thinking about the analytical engine.
So you're trying to raise 500,000 pounds, about $1 million, to build this.
Yes, I'm trying to get 50,000 people to say they'll put up $10, pounds, or euros, depending on what your currency is, to kick it off. It is going to probably need more. We know from the cost of the Difference engine, cost about £400,000, and this has got some research behind it. But I think that one of the goals will be actually to digitize all of Babbage's papers, because they're not available on the web. And they're in the Science Museum in London. And so this is really an educational thing, as well as ultimately trying to build this computer and show that in 1837, Babbage had invented a general-purpose digital computer with a printer, a plotter, punch cards, microcode, instruction pipelining, you name it. And it's kind of amazing that it's 100 years later in 1937 that you had Alan Turing, who wrote his famous paper in which he laid out the Turing machine. And so part of what I'm saying is there's 100 years here that were sort of lost.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you one question. After you finish doing this steam computer, steam powered computer, are you going to go one more step and do a steam powered internet?
wasn't that a Stevenson book? Kind of along those lines.
Behind me, actually, I have the Victorian internet somewhere here. Yeah. That actually is a whole other interesting thing, which is the telegraph and how that operated in this era. So the era that Babbage was working, not long after that, because the British Empire was very big, and you keep the British Empire under control with the telegraph. It was possible to telegraph a message from London to Bombay in the middle of the 1800s in 8 minutes, which makes you think the internet now, I mean, it's only a little bit faster than that.
A little bit. I think it's interesting. The Turing machine was never built either. A lot of these were kind of mental exercises more than. Although I guess Babbage expected it to be built at some point.
Now, there's a huge distinction, right? Which is that Babbage was building something practical. He saw real use of it. Turing was laying down the fundamentals of computer science. So there's a very, you know, for me, Babbage is a computer pioneer and Turing a computer science pioneer. Right. So they're doing slightly different things.
That makes sense.
Of course, the interesting thing is, looking back, Babbage's machine was Turing complete. It was a computer that we would recognize.
He'd already done that thinking, hadn't he?
He hadn't realized that there was only one Turingness. But yeah, he'd built it. Wow. So,
man, this is the ultimate steampunk project.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there's nothing not steampunk about it. It's pure awesome.
this is the ultimate steampunk project, and I will probably have to start dressing up in Victorian clothing if I get this.
You will.
Thing,
so. It's a sad fact, but you will.
The top hat and goggles are on their way. If people want to pledge, now you've only got 101 pledges. I'm going to pledge some money into this as well. In fact, I'll tell you what. You've got 101 people donating $10. Why don't I just double that and put another $1,010 in there? At least you'll be a little bit closer. Wow. You need 50,000 people to make this happen. So I may be throwing. I guess I don't pay anything unless you get the 50,000.
Are you using Kickstarter for this or something else?
Actually, I'm not using Kickstarter because Kickstarter only accepts if you have a U.S. bank account. I'm using a thing called Pledge Bank, which is very similar, and it operates worldwide. It's a very similar idea. The only difference is you don't actually have to give your credit card number or anything. It's just I'm willing to do this. And the reason I picked 50,000 is that when I did the Alan Turing apology petition last year,
which you succeeded in.
Yes, I did. Yes, I got 35,000 people in Britain to sign that. So this project is worldwide. So I'm betting that I have a good chance of getting 50,000 people to say, yes, $10 is enough to go and see a truck-sized steam-powered brass computer.
Well, if we have enough people listening that if only 20% of the people listening donated, I think you'd be there. So everybody get out and do it.
That sounds fantastic.
Go to John's site, which is jgc.org?
.org. It is .org. And then you can see under my blog, there's a link on the right-hand side there where it says pledge. It's in a hideous purple color. You can't miss it under the blog. So.
And then I just signed up at Pledge Bank. And I will. I guess Pledge Bank doesn't give you an opportunity to say how much you're pledging.
What you can do if you want to be public and say, hey, I'm willing to give more, because somebody has said that, there's actually a comment section where you can say, I'll give you $100 or whatever you feel like.
So I'm going to put 1,000 in because I really want you to do this. But I have one request is that we get to cover live the switch flip.
Here's what I've been thinking about. I wonder what this thing sounds like when it boots.
Oh, can you imagine?
when it crashes, it literally crashes.
No, we'll put 1,000 in and we'll raise money. I want to get this going. I think this is a great project. It's perfect for the 173rd anniversary of the Babbage analytical machine. I mean, what better time to do it, and I'm glad to put some money in, and we would love to cover this the process of building it. I know it's all the way in London, but I think this is great. And if there are any millionaires listening, you could just cut to the chase right now.
Yeah, we'll just get it done tomorrow. Get on with it.
Just imagine what a great museum piece this would make.
And also the important side of it, there's also this very much research educational side to it. It's not just a folly of let's build a massive brass machine. I do want to do that bit. But we have to understand what Babbage really was saying and do the research. So I'm looking forward to it.
Good. Nothing to knock folly, let me tell you. I would never discourage anyone's folly. So go to jgc.org and follow the link, the purple link to the pledge bank, and pledge. I bet we could get 10,000 people.
Just by the end of the show?
By the end of the show. Just for just because you really want us to do this. You know, $10. What does that cost? $10. It's well worth it. You can stop your donation and no agenda for a few weeks.
Hey.
I thought I would get a rise.
Don't take the money out of our pockets.
For the price of a week of no agenda, you can help build the analytical engine.
How about a week of no agenda? How much do you ask people on No Agenda for?
How much?
Yeah. Do you like have a set donation?
No. We have, you go to noagendashow.com or dvorak.org/NA, and there's a huge variety of opportunities.
But, and you get different things if you donate different amounts.
Yeah, you can become a knight, which I'm sure our British friend would appreciate.
Yes, a knight.
Buying a knighthood is probably the wrong thing to do over here.
See, if I had given you $1,000 instead of this Babbage thing, I could have been a knight of the No Agenda Roundtable.
Sir Leo.
Or Leo,
if you want to get...
There's a knight layaway plan.
Layaway plan, there is.
That's the 20-month program with $50 for 20 months. You know, about 3 months into that $50 a month thing, I have a feeling people might have second thoughts. I don't know. I'm just guessing. And then there's the $33.33 Mothership boarding pass. So you can be on the Mothership that Adam tells us is coming. But there's other things. There's the $5 a month subscription. There's the lucky $30 Mo sub. You're very clever in this.
It never ends.
It's very clever. Why is it lucky to give $30 a month?
We don't know.
We just know it is.
Yeah. It's just all empirical, the feedback we get.
We just know it's lucky.
It is. It's very lucky.
Oh, Lord. All right, let's take a break. And because I got to make some money so I can give this $1,000 to a truly good cause, the Babbage Analytical Machine. I just think it's so cool that he essentially came up with the principles of computer science 173 years ago, in the 1840s. I mean, that's amazing.
Truly he missed amazing. A couple of things, but not much.
What did he miss?
Well, the program wasn't stored inside the computer, so it was on the cards. It wasn't loaded into memory.
He didn't have RAM.
Well, he had RAM, but it was only for... The RAM was, you know, made of brass, but it was only for storage of numbers, basically, not for the program.
Interesting.
And the other thing he didn't do was he didn't let the program... address memory. It was fixed memory location, so you couldn't do things like arrays.
Right.
But he had enough power in there.
He would have no doubt figured it out had he done it.
I want you to design that thing so it can run APL.
Then you have to have a special keyboard. Was there a keyboard? Was there any user entry?
Yeah, there
entry?
Was. A special whack job keyboard.
No, not for APL, for the Babbage Analytical.
For APL, yeah.
APL, I
well,
know.
Well, no, actually, you had to punch cards, and then you fed everything in on cards. So you put in your program, your numbers, everything, and it would punch cards out.
I love it. What a great idea. Hey, before we go on, I do want to mention Ford. We were talking about autonomous cars. I had a great time driving that Ford Flex with it. It was actually really cool. I didn't do it right, but you're looking for parking space. No, it's a fairly big car because it seats like 8 or something. So you press the button that says, find me a parking space. And you're driving along, and it spots a space that's big enough, and the little light goes on, and then it says, pull forward. So you pull forward, pull forward, pull forward, pull forward, and it says, okay, stop. Then it says, now, park. And you press the button, and the wheel goes, bzz, bzz, and it parallel parks you automatically. Now, my mistake was, I should have thought about this, that I took my hands off the wheel, but I also took my feet off the brake. They didn't mention to me that, well, actually, once you're parked, you probably should put your foot on the brake because the car is idling. It will continue to back up. So I'm just like going, wow, this is cool. And I'm with my hands and feet in the air. And, of course, the car parks perfectly and then continues to back up into the Fiesta behind me. Now, the good news is I was wearing a helmet, so I was uninjured, and neither the Flex nor the Fiesta took even a ding. I mean, they looked fantastic. I think we were going, by the time we hit the Fiesta, because it was a bit of a ways, we were going 8 or 9 miles an hour. It jerked me, but anyway, they're working on this stuff, this bliss stuff that lets you know if there's a car in your blind spot, and there's some really cool stuff in there. But the technology that you know I love the best in my Ford Mustang, they call it Ford Sync. Now they call it My Ford Touch. It's the amazing turn-by-turn directions, voice-activated, music search, traffic alerts, audible text messages, 911 assist in the Ford Sync My Ford Touch. It's amazing. It's amazing. Essentially, Ford made a very clever decision. They said, we're going to build this capability into the car, but it will use the capability of the phone, because these phones are getting upgraded all the time. So as the phone capabilities improve, automatically, my Ford Touch gets smarter. So, for instance, I have the new Android Droid X. Well, when a text message comes in, and you could turn this off, but I have it set so that my Ford Touch says, bing, there's a text message. I could say, read it to me. It reads me the message, then gives me a set of canned responses I could send back. All without taking my eyes off the road or my hands off the wheel. I mean, it's just fantastic. Of course, if you've got an iPod or an iPhone with Bluetooth, or it's got an iPod USB connector, so you can connect any device via USB, it'll play the USB device, the songs, of course, but it also, you can command a song. You can say, play U2, and it'll play U2. You can say, play next, play more like that. You can say, call John. And it'll call John. I mean, it is so fantastic. Works with your Bluetooth-enabled phone. On most phones, not only can you make calls, but you can also listen to music. You get turn-by-turn directions without buying a more expensive GPS device with a big screen. You get personalized traffic alerts. It knows your route, and it'll send you traffic alerts as you go. It'll even reroute you with turn-by-turn directions. It is hands-free calling at its best. I want you to try it. Go to any Ford, Lincoln, or Mercury dealer. Say, I want to see the Sync, the My Ford Touch, or you can go to SyncMyRidePodcast.com to find out more. They've got lots of videos and demos and so forth. And next week, I think I'm going to talk about the Ford Edge, because this is this is their highest tech vehicle. This car has every wonderful feature in there. I'm just really excited about it. Ford is taking the state of the art to the next level. My Ford Touch at your Ford, Lincoln, or Mercury dealer, or visit SyncMyRidePodcast.com. John Graham Cumming is here from JGC.org. He is a computer scientist, right? I mean, you work in the computer business.
I am a nerd.
He's yes. A nerd. Also the author of The Geek Atlas, which is a wonderful, beautiful book with 128. Is that how many it is? Beautiful geek sites that you should see.
It is 128 places, yes.
All the places you should get
to. I want to go.
You should.
So, since we're off topic, I want to show you something.
All right.
How'd we get off topic? We just came out of the ad.
Look.
Don't deny, John. Is that an
this
avocado?
This is an avocado.
Wow, that is a huge avocado there, John.
That's an alligator pear. It's a Haas.
No. It doesn't have any of those little bumps on it.
Oh, what is that then?
It's a Mexican avocado.
Okay.
You know what they say, the bigger the avocado...
I'll tell you something. I bet you this thing tastes like crap.
Well, thanks for sharing it with us, John. Go make some guacamole. Now, I can't understand. I'm watching the baseball playoffs, and TBS has ads for avocado. Just avocado.
Yeah.
Like, who pays for that?
The Avocado Council or the Haas Company, which is not the same as the avocado. It's the name of some distributor.
I don't even understand it, because I mean I grew avocados. We sold them in the store. Aren't there a million different avocado growers? Is there like one? Is there like somebody who's so big that it's worth buying the baseball playoffs?
Who eats avocados outside of California?
Oh, maybe that's the issue. They're trying.
Are you kidding me? All over the place.
Really?
Everybody eats guacamole.
I've never seen a good avocado in New York.
Guacamole. That's what's changed, John.
Well, there are other places besides New York in the world.
Really?
All of Texas, New Mexico, Arizona.
Oh, yeah, guacamole.
In New Mexico.
In Austin, they love the guac, don't they?
You can't find a good avocado in Wyoming.
Maybe
I don't know. I've never looked for one. You may be right.
That's why they're buying the ads, because they want the world to know.
And I'm looking at the chat room, and here's a guy Lenin 2010 says guacamole is nasty.
See?
I mean, come on. How can that be?
Well, you were the one who said your avocado probably doesn't taste very good.
No, that avocado's got to be a dog. Come on.
Hey, you
watery,
know,
tasteless.
No, that looks good. Not all avocados are bumpy.
I know, but very few of them, that, besides the Haas variety, are they have that intense avocado flavor.
Mm. By the way, Waz is going to join me and Tom this week, Wednesday, 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, for a one-on-one discussion.
I guess it'd be a two-on-one discussion.
That's right. It's kind of like that triangulate thing, John, that we were going to do, where we're going to start bringing in some big names. We've got John Perry Barlow next week. We're going to bring in some big names. And Tom and I, right after TNT, our week, our daily news hour, which is, by the way, starts at 2:30 Pacific, 5:30 Eastern at live.twit.tv. So Tom will do TNT, and then we'll come right out of it, and we'll be talking to the Waz. That'll be fun. I look forward to that.
Yeah, I can't wait.
You know, we've had Waz on Wiz. We've had Waz on Twit before. But, you know, it really makes sense just when you get somebody like that to just spend time with them and not ask them to, you know, talk about the tech news and stuff like that.
Like comment on why Carol Bartz thinks Facebook is creepy.
Yeah. Does she?
Like, apparently.
Mm. I think Carol Bartz is creepy.
Mm. Well, here we go.
She said in an interview that she thinks Facebook is creepy. I don't care to find an old boyfriend one time just to see if they got fat and bald, but then leave me alone. But I'm old. Well, that was a quote.
The only thing that's good about Carol Bartz, actually, it's not the only thing, but one of the great things about Carol Bartz, former Autodesk CEO and now CEO at Yahoo, is unlike most CEOs, she speaks her mind. And she even said F you to Mike Arrington, which I thought was, you know, put her in a very small select group.
Well, I don't think it's a very small group, to be honest about
it. No, actually, I started a Facebook group. People have said F you to Mike Arrington, and there's about 4,000 of us now. What do you think of these Facebook groups? I've used them a couple of times. In fact, I invited Tom. You're in the host, Twit Hosts group. That's a private group.
I thought you quit Facebook, Leo.
I had to go back because I couldn't cover the damn story, John. Right? I had to go back. You know when I went back, John, is when they introduced Places, and I said, "Well, I can't talk about Places because I don't have Places," and so I'm keeping my eyes on them, so I know what they're up to. That's all. No, I admit it's kind of my tail between my legs. I have to say, praise for Facebook. I'll be the first to praise them for one of the things they did this week, which was they announced that you can now download all of your Facebook content as a big old zip file. It's an HTML file with all the pictures. Not only
the
all
biggest
this,
mistake they've ever made.
I know. They opened the door, didn't they? All the pictures. And not only that, but all the pictures other people have taken and tagged you in. Why is that a mistake, John?
Well, obviously, you have that other movement going on, the open source Facebook. And any competitor that comes along now, you know, they got this from the bloggers, you know, the idea of the bloggers. You know, if you run Typepad, you can export it to WordPress.
Yeah.
You can do all these kind of cool things. But they essentially had a captive audience, and now they're saying, yeah, you can go wherever you want now. You can quit our system when something better comes along. What kind of marketing idea is this?
I think it's good marketing. It gives people... This is called responsible marketing. Instead of trying to trap people in your roach motel.
You already had them trapped, though. It's not like you're trying to do anything sneaky.
That's true. They're already
trapped. They could have just ignored the idea.
So, John, you're saying you've got them. Why let them out?
Sorry.
Well, MySpace didn't allow people to take their data with them, and everybody left them anyway. And I don't think most people are going to go to the trouble to export all of this data. Necessarily.
Right. Let me write the date of this down. Hold on a second, Tom. I need to write the date down.
Tenth,
where
tenth,
you've,
tenth.
You've just
well,
predicted that
it's 10-10-10 in America. But John, you in England, you'd probably write it 10-10-10.
Right.
That's correct. Yes. Luckily, today is the one of those few days when we can agree on what the day is.
And I suppose we should commemorate it because, although this I think is stretching it considerably, 101010 is binary for the number 42. Which, as everyone
That's
knows,
right.
is the answer to the question of life, the universe, and everything.
I think we're coming to that answer today.
You know, like next year, 11, 11, 11, well, that's binary, what, 128? Ooh.
And well, 128, yeah.
Ooh. 128, that's the first memory that you got in an original Macintosh. Yeah.
See, and then 12, 12, 12, that's nothing.
It's not 128, Leo, it's 127.
I'm sorry.
Oh, well.
Sorry to rain on your parade.
Damn. 127 was the highway.
Now, wait a minute, John. Did you enter that into a calculator or you just knew that off the top of your head?
I knew that off the top of my head.
All right. He's a geek.
All right. It was a good idea.
Seven ones. Eight ones is 256. So seven ones. But eight ones is not 256. It's 255.
Well, somebody says it's actually 63.
Wait a minute. Is 8 1? Oh, yeah, because we're talking six. It's six to, ones. It's so it's 63. It's six ones.
Six ones. 63.
So it's half of 128.
So we'd like to find anyone who's 63 years 63. Old on that day. Yep. That would be interesting.
If you're 63 years old today on 10-10-10, happy birthday. That's all.
And 12-12-12 in base 2 is nothing. It doesn't mean anything. Because
there's no 2.
There's no 2.
Yeah. Keith's in here. Keith, what birthday is this for you today? He's 55. So if you're 55 on 10-10-10, nothing. You don't get a prize or anything. But it is his birthday.
So let's go to a couple of news stories that fascinate me.
What fascinates you today, John C.
Google responds to Oracle's Android patent lawsuit.
Yeah, did you like the response?
What was it?
Well, this is Gizmodo. Oh, no, I'm in Gadget writing, we break it down. And basically, they broke it down into this one sentence. Google says Android doesn't infringe on any of Oracle's patents. And even if it does, those patents are invalid and or unenforceable for a variety of reasons anyway. So, you know, shove it.
We don't violate any of your patents. And even if we did, your patents suck.
So there.
Let's take your patents just how, to go.
Oracle and Sun.
Especially
just,
how patent law works.
Yeah.
That's how patents work, right? I mean, you just say no. And even if I did, no. And even if I did, no.
Right. And then let the courts sort it out.
Yeah, unfortunately. Moving on.
So that's it on that one, huh? You're done with that one now.
Do you know anything about Thimble.net?
No, what is that?
It's a decentralized Twitter.
Well,
has anybody heard of this?
Is there an E in it or is it T-H-I-M-B-L?
Yep. .net.
Thimble with no E, .net. And the idea is it's a manifesto, so it's not actually doing anything, for the open web written in code. Oh, well, maybe it is doing something.
It's not the Birchcroft Finebone China site, then. You have to drop the E out of Thimble.
Ah, you see, you put a thimble in there. The most significant challenge, the open web will... I don't know why everything is underlined on here. This is a bad sign. That's not good.
Yeah.
I guess,
well, at least it's not all centered. That's my favorite one.
It's close. It's close. They've got...
How is this different from Identica?
Yeah, Identica is, or status.net as it's called. We're going to actually move. We have a Identica microblog called the Twit Army, army.twit.tv, which we are going to move to status.net. They do hosting. And yeah, that's the idea is it is federated so that, in fact, it works very well. If you want to follow some, it doesn't work with Twitter or Facebook because they won't open it up. But if you want to follow somebody on status.net or Identica, from our Twit Army, you just add their address and you're following them and it's in your stream. Welcome to Thimble, the free open source distributed micro blogging platform. If you're tired of being locked into one, you know, I might go there because you know what Twitter just did to me? Let me see if it still happened.
What did they do to you now?
Oh, man.
They've been screwing you over, Leo.
Oh, stop trying to start a fight. Let me see if it's still that way.
The fact.
So if you go to twitter.com/LeoLaporte, that's my tweets.
I'm the real Dvorak, by the way, for anyone who wants to add me.
So if you scroll back in time, you get 6 October, 6, 5 October, 3 October. Oh, good. 1 October. They lost 2.5, for a while, they had lost 2.5 years worth of tweets. It looks like they're back, though, thank goodness. They had to do it before.
You don't want to lose those.
For like several days. Yeah. Everything I'd written.
What was in there that was so important, Leo?
I don't know. I can't see it. Oh, I tweet importance. Anyway, it's all back. Thank goodness. Yeah, for a while, they lost all my tweets for 2.5 years worth of tweets. But okay.
This Thimble thing, do they actually have code, these Thimble guys, or are they just saying we want to make something free and open and
could be a whole huggetry
or something?
They say
it's a manifesto in code, so it's like they have code.
You have to allow scripts from googleapis.com if you want it to show you any content, though. That's kind of a weird design choice.
The whole thing is weird. And it's by a company called Telecommunisten.
Oh, the communists are at it.
I think it's communists.
We still have communists?
No.
Yeah. Communists. The only entertainment you can get nowadays.
What do you think of Google TV? I mean, we're looping around again, but $299, the Logitech review. It's one of the units. There's a Sony unit. Presumably, yeah, there'll be others as well.
I saw this over at the Intel Developers Conference a month or so ago. They had it. And it's a Harmony controller, for one thing.
Right.
Which is about $200 anyway. Those things are expensive.
Well, so yeah, for $299, you're getting a very well. You can use your iPhone or your Android phone as a remote. That's kind of cool. I ordered one just because we got to talk about it. But I don't know if I would recommend anybody order it at this point. What do you think, Tom?
I think it's early, yeah, and I think I'd probably get one just for the same reason, so I can play with it in my house and see how it works. But I don't see this yet as the box. If I were to recommend to somebody right now, hey, I want to get my parents something so they can watch internet video really easily, I'd get them a Roku.
Yes, I'd agree.
Because it's small, it's simple, it's $60 for the base one, and it's really dead simple to teach somebody how to use it. The complications come in signing up for the service, if you sign them up for Netflix or you sign them up for Hulu. But once they're going with it, it just kind of works. Google TV does a lot more, and it's a smarter bet because you can use it on different platforms. It's not locked into one box. But right now, I don't think it's so dead simple for people.
You know, I think it's a big deal that Hulu Plus is going to be on Roku. That means that Roku will have most of the content you would want. I mean, you can watch us on Roku, which is great. You can watch Amazon, Netflix. It won't have iTunes, but the Apple TV has that and Netflix only. What do you use, John? Do you do anything?
I have a Roku box I don't use. I don't use anything. I use the DVR from the Dish Network, and that's about it. But I'm seriously thinking of going a little retro because they have new HD TV channels that are apparently quite nice. I think, and I want somebody to send me some literature or some recommendations, because I know some of the listeners out there do this. I want to go with a big C-band dish.
You can get them cheap right now. They're cheap.
You just want to catch the people, the feeds of the folks talking when they're off the air.
They still do that. Yeah, you can still catch that
stuff. Do they still do that? I thought they started scrambling that.
I have a pad in the backyard. I can put a big C-band dish on there. And Leo, you're on the sticks. You should have two of them. And we can get the real deal, you know, the real big, the bandwidth there with that big dish.
A C-band dish.
You know, in all seriousness, that is the best way to get access to all the content. The problem with it is you can't get it on demand. You have to wait until it gets broadcast and then DVR it. What the box that we're waiting for should do is allow you to see what's being broadcast right now from your C-band dish or whatever, and be able to get Hulu, Netflix, essentially every online video version of every show that's available. Nobody's going to be able to do that unless you get licensing cleared up. Even Google's got a great interface here, but as long as the licensing windows are so messed up where not everything is available from everybody at every point, it's hopeless, and you are stuck just watching it on broadcast and recording it.
I'm going to get Charles Babbage's analytical engine to power my TV.
Yeah, just wait.
I'll have to put wood. Oh, we'll watch TV in a moment. I've got to fire up the boilers, honey.
That's right.
It's practically like that right now. I mean, my wife is so mad at me because she says, I just want to watch TV. How do I watch TV? She cannot watch TV unless I'm there because it requires the use of three separate remotes. And I don't see a Google TV really changing that. In fact, now you've got a keyboard, a mouse. I mean, oh, honey, it's no problem. You just go to the command prompt and type CDNBC, and you'll find all of the – just do an LS there. You'll find all of the NBC shows listed. And when you want to run one, it's a run dash T LTQ space and then the name of the show. If you want to run it in a widescreen, then another dash WS. I think she'll like that. Or maybe she can, we can do it all in Python.
If there's anything friends and family members love, it's learning command switches.
I'm convinced. No, my wife is convinced, and I'm convinced she's probably right. It's just a plot by geeks to make it so that you can't watch TV without them. You watched TV without me?
So they're up to 259 donations already for the analytical engine.
Woohoo! That's good. We've doubled it.
Wonderful.
Yay!
My advice, take the money and run.
No, he doesn't get any money. Right?
I don't get any money.
You don't get any money unless you get 50,000 people, and then what happens? You get a check?
And then half of them forgot what it was for.
Right.
That's all right. I'll go back and
find a millionaire.
Forget.
Find a millionaire is always the best idea. We're going to take a break, come back. When we do, Mark Zuckerberg finally saw the Facebook movie. We'll tell you what he thought in just a little bit. But first, I want to talk about Audible.com. The great place to go to get your audio entertainment. I'm a huge Audible fan. I think you know that. I listen to Audible all the time. Right now, and it's because of you. I blame you for this one, Tom. I'm listening to what will probably be the longest series I've ever listened to, the Dark Tower series by Stephen King.
Mm-hmm.
Just completing the first one, The Gunslinger. You never listened to it either, had you?
I haven't, and I have yet to start because we're doing T.H. White on Sword and Laser, so that's my current audiobook.
Oh, E.B. White, you mean.
T.H. White, the Once and Future King, which is sold on Audible if you're looking for it in the three parts, because it was originally put out as three different books.
Oh, interesting. So you have to buy it as three different books.
Right.
The Once and Future King is one of the best books I've ever read. It's the story of, it's one of many stories about an Arthurian legend. I'm actually surprised that Veronica let you do that.
She actually was, it was a vote. It was a fan vote. And she actually horned in The Princess Bride as a second selection.
Because I know she loves the fact that you know everything there is to know about Arthurian legend. But I have a feeling.
I wish I did.
That, well, you know, I don't see it on Audible. You sure it's on Audible?
Look for the Sword and the Stone.
They call it the Sword and the Stone?
That's the name of the first book.
I get it. Because it's the Once and Future King is the full.
Yeah. So if you just search for T.H. White, you'll find it.
I see it here. I didn't put in the dots. So there's the Sword and the Stone, the Witch in the Wood, and the Ill-Made Knight, A Candle in the Wind.
That's the second book.
Yeah.
It's actually two combined.
So I can see why it's three books, because these are a total of 32 hours.
Yeah, it's quite a tome. It's like Lord of the Rings. You know, that was actually the opposite. Tolkien conceived it as one book, and they made him break it up into three because it was so long.
This is, I would say, the best written, best, and you know, the best example of Arthurian legend. I just loved it. T.H. White, one of our best writers. Didn't he write the Making of the President as well? Was that him? I think so. Let's listen to a little of The Sword and the Stone here.
Said Sir Grummore, laying his finger by his nose and winking at the bottle. That takes a deal of thinking about, if you don't mind my saying so. Don't mind at all, said Sir Ector. Very kind of you to say anything. Much obliged, I'm sure. Help yourself to port.
Do you find this pretty easy to listen to? It seems like it'd be very fun and easy to listen to.
Yeah, and it's the right kind of reader for that story.
Oh, yeah. You got to have somebody very, very British. The Sword and the Stone.
Can you look up a book that is my current favorite book?
Yeah.
Just came out. I know it's on Kindle, but I haven't seen I don't know if it's on Audible, but this is the book I recommend.
How to Resist Federal Tyranny in the 21st...
Nullification is the name of the book.
Oh, Nullification. Isn't that a crackpot theory?
It's not a theory. It's the 10th Amendment.
All right. It is on Audible if you want to listen to it. So, okay, we'll have two recommendations. There's the Sword and Laser Book of the Month, which is the Once and Future King. Search for the Sword and the Stone. It's all there. And then Nullification, How to Resist Federal... Let's just listen to what Alan Sklar sounds like. And then Sir Hector said, it's the 10th Amendment. Let's see what he says.
Ongoing and apparently unstoppable government growth are beginning to wonder if some other strategy should be pursued. The exclusively electoral one having been such a failure.
Is it's
Nullification is based on the 10th Amendment, which says that State law, unless it's specifically in the Constitution, state law trumps federal law in all cases. And federal laws that are either unconstitutional or let's say, for example, legalized marijuana in California, Proposition 19.
I was just that thinking violates, that's what you're doing here.
That violates
federal law,
but right. As a state law, it trumps the federal law because it's not in the Constitution. That's why they passed the Volstead Act for prohibition
to
make it constitutional.
Law. Right. Had to be a constitutional amendment.
Right. So when 19 passes, if it passes, it should.
I think it's gone.
The feds are going to probably sue the state of California, claiming that, oh, you can't do that because we have a federal law that says marijuana is illegal. And the whole thing is all based on the 10th Amendment. That California is within its rights to do that.
But that's not really what this is all about.
Yes, that's what it's about.
What it's really all about. It's not about marijuana.
Yeah.
Come on.
Okay, it's about a lot of things. Basically about the states telling the feds to shove it.
Yeah, I guess it could be whatever your agenda happens to be.
Yeah. Well, in my case, I have none.
Well, you might like this then. The Manchurian president, Barack Obama's ties to communists, socialists, and other anti-American extremists, also on Audible.
See, I already read the Malkin book. What else can they say?
The beauty of this is Audible has books on politics from both sides of the aisle. Or sometimes completely off the aisle. I don't know where the hell this one is. And this is the beauty of it. You can hear opinions, facts. This is the great thing about Audible is you're learning in the time that you spend driving home on your commute or doing the housework or at the gym. I listen at the gym every single day. That gives me an hour a day of reading. I'm getting great reading done. And you know what I do is I alternate because sometimes, you know, I listen to a book like this and I get all steamed. And then I listen to a little bit of fiction like The Gunslinger or the Sword in the Stone. And then I feel much better. And then I listen to another book. It gets me steamed. And then I listen to some fiction. And I go back and forth. Believe it or not, two books a month is not enough for me. I love Audible. But I'm going to set you up here with the Platinum account. That's two books a month. It's a good way to start. The first month is free. That means you're going to get two books absolutely free. They're yours to keep forever. You can cancel at any time. But it's a good way of getting introduced. So why don't we give you two books? We'll give you The Sword and the Stone. That'll make you smile. And also get you ready for The Sword and the Laser. And Nullification by Thomas E. Woods. I actually want to listen to this, John. Because I'm looking forward to fighting the feds.
I'm telling you, you'll be a convert.
No, I think this is... You know, I think I'm a favor of states' rights. I think that's appropriate. It's in the 10th Amendment, as you said. How to Resist Federal Tyranny in the 21st Century. We'll find out more about that. 4.5 stars. On this one. People like this book. Audible.com/twit2. Give it a try. I think you will like it. All kinds of books. Fiction, nonfiction, classics, sci-fi, self-help. There's books for teens and young adults. There's books for little kids, too. Audible.com/twit2. And if you're in the UK, as our good friend, who is gone now, John Graham Cumming is.
I'm here.
But your picture has disappeared. There it is.
I will reappear.
As John, I hear the analytic engine running in the basement.
It's the washing machine.
If you're in the UK, there is Audible UK, but the books are different and so forth. And some of the offers may be different, but it's worth a try. Absolutely.
Books are all in English, too.
That's one of the things I like about the Audible UK, folks. Audible.com/twit2. We thank them so much for their support. So Mark Zuckerberg said, I'm not going to go see the social network. He said, I'll never see that.
Yeah, big talk.
Yeah. Well, it was a big talk. Apparently, he shut down the Facebook offices, bought out a theater so they wouldn't see him cry, and took the entire Facebook staff of 400 or 500 people to see the movie. Now, I think that's kind of interesting. Apparently,
did they boo?
Well, we don't know because there's no spy in there. But this is an article published by Lucy McDonald, showbiz correspondent for Sky News. She says Jesse Eisenberg, who plays Mark in the film, has a cousin who's a senior staffer at Facebook, of all things, and is close to Mark. Afterwards, he emailed Jesse to say Mark really liked the parts of the movie he agreed with. This is a quote. This is actually Aaron Sorkin talking. So we don't know. We don't know what he agreed with. And I think everybody knows that there are things in the movie that never happened.
Do you know that movie was sped up to meet time requirements?
Really? How do you know that?
They used two technologies. They used both the fact that they, you know, where you change the frame rate and you keep the voices exactly the same, right, so it sounds natural. And then they pull frames out to give it kind of a more hectic quality.
You know, it's funny you should say that.
It's actually a 3-hour movie.
It's funny you should say that because it felt that way to me, and I thought it was just Aaron Sorkin's boom 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 writing. It felt hectic to me. It felt sped up to me. I was a little anxious.
Sped up. It was unnaturally fast.
You know, we had Dana Brunetti, the producer of the film from Trigger Street, on Net at Night last week. I should have asked him about that. That's fascinating. I had no idea. I'll send him an email and ask him to confirm or deny.
Yeah.
It should have been a longer movie. It seemed a little frantic.
Apparently, whoever was at the top of the studio said, hey, this movie, we can't have it that long. So they said, I have an idea. Let's just speed it up.
Wow. Have you all seen it? You liked it?
I saw it, yeah.
What'd you think, Tom?
I thought it was a great movie. If you don't care anything about the Facebook story or social networking, you're not in social media, you're not inside the bubble. Great movie, well written, well shot, all that. Very nice story. If you were going to it wanting to see the story of Facebook, well, like many Hollywood movies, you're not really going to see that. There's a lot of gaping holes in it, and Sorkin modified things to make a good story, and he made a good story. Yeah. But it's not a biography. It's not as true to the Facebook situation as, you know, I put it on Twitter. It's like as the lion in winter is to Henry II,
right,
the social network is to Mark Zuckerberg.
This is why I follow Tom on Twitter. Abstruse illusions like that. Let's bring his Twitter feed to life.
Somebody in the chat rooms asked the rhetorical question, chat roulette in 3D?
Don't know what to say about that.
No,
sorry.
I just thought it was funny.
Facebook did it. We started talking about it. I didn't get to finish this. I mentioned that the download thing, but they also added Facebook groups. We've been using groups, as I said. But there is a flaw in groups, which a number of people have pointed out, is that anybody can add you to a group. Well, not anybody. Any of your friends can add you to a group. Somebody added Jason Calacanis to a group called NAMBLA. Not the same NAMBLA. Not the National Association for Man Boy Love, but a group created specifically for the purpose of embarrassing people. Now, this is a problem because Jason added, I think he was like me with Facebook originally, he added anybody who has to be a friend. So he has the 5,000 friends, the limit, and obviously they're not really friends. Facebook's point of view is, look, if you make somebody your friend, that means you trust them enough to not add you to groups you shouldn't be added to. And therein lies the rub. Not only that, once you get added to a group, you get a ton of email from that group. Are you on Facebook, John? Because I tried to find you so I could add you to a group.
Sorry, no.
Damn.
For that reason alone.
I had some good groups I was going to subscribe you to. Tom, I'm sure you've had this happen now. People have added you to groups. Have you noticed the sudden flood of email? It's the only notice you get.
The only groups I've been added to were by you.
So you didn't get it.
Thanks, Leo.
No, because about a year or so ago, I changed how I use Facebook because I saw them starting to integrate this data into more and more places. I said, I can't use this as an open, like, I'll let anyone follow me, I'll follow anyone sort of situation. It's becoming too personal. Not by my own choice, but by the way Facebook is saying, we're going to use your contact list. We're going to make it integrated into this and that. And I'm like, well, wait a minute. I don't want that. So I went through and I purged my friend list of anyone that I didn't actually know. And most people understood it. A few people got their nose bent out of shape. But after I explained, like, hey, it's nothing against you. I'm just the way Facebook is using this data now, I need to make sure I protect it. And I'm glad I did that because now with this groups thing, I haven't been added to any groups because I'm not like Calacanis where he's got everybody that he can possibly up to the 5,000 person max follow. And so far my friends have not been that funny.
Yeah,
well, that killed the show.
Well, no, I'm just thinking about this whole idea. You know, I think the reason Facebook does this is because there's a lot more. Well, first of all, remember that Google presentation they did in Europe where it said, here's the problem with friends is that there isn't just one monolithic group of friends. There's different kinds of friends. There's coworkers. There's people you went to school with. There's people you hang out at the bars with. There's different kinds of friends. And perhaps these groups shouldn't really overlap. If you're a school teacher, for instance, and you have some of your students are friends because you want to mentor them, you may not want to have pictures of you at the bar sent to them. So I think Facebook, realizing that they needed to address this issue, because the way it is on Facebook up to now has been you're either a friend or not, right? There's no... So they made friends lists, but then Mark Zuckerberg quite rightly realized nobody ever wants to make lists. That's a pain in the ass. So they created these groups, and I think the groups actually do exactly what they wanted, because you don't have to do all the work. Your friends help add people to the groups. The groups kind of form themselves naturally, and now you can have a group of school chums that sees pictures that are different from the group of barmates. And I think that's a good way to do it. I just think that they have to tweak it a little bit, because it is sending a lot of email and maybe a little bit of a surprise.
Well, and not everybody has been using Facebook the way
that's the real problem.
Would like them to.
That's the real problem, isn't it? Yeah.
I mean, I dealt with this a while ago. I did a very similar thing, which is that I deleted everybody who wasn't an actual friend or family from Facebook. And that was most of my friends were colleagues. And I decided I'd put people who were colleagues on LinkedIn.
Yeah.
And they could see from me there. And anybody wanted to deal with me in public on Twitter. So I just used three different services. And on Facebook, it's totally friends and family. Because I think this dividing into groups is just way too complicated. I'm bound to accidentally send a picture of me completely drunk to all my coworkers.
Well, we don't have to ask what Facebook's motivation is. It's just the more information about your social graph, who you know, who you don't know, and how you're related to them. And the more they get of that, the more valuable that information is. I mean, it's...
Can you opt out of groups?
I don't believe you can. Or yes, you can. Wait a minute. I take that back. I think there is a button that says, I will not be part of groups. Let me see.
But I think it's all of them at once, not...
Right.
It's an all or nothing proposition.
Well, you can quit a group.
You can quit a group, but I think you can block and say, don't ever add me to a group. But you can't say, allow me to approve every group before I'm added to it. If you're added to a group by a friend,
You could do that. Yeah, they really need a setting for that.
We've been through that with email, right, with email lists, getting added to them or actually opting into them. I think Facebook probably ought to make this an opt-in thing where you say, do you want to be part of this group? And you confirm it.
You know, already there's kind of an interesting use of this. There is a Robert Scoble started a couple of groups, one called Tech Leaders and Influencers and one called Tech News Bloggers. And Facebook responded to these criticisms within the Tech News Bloggers. I mean, what a great way for Facebook to go right to the people who are talking about this issue.
And, were they members or were they just spying on the group?
Oh, that's a good question. I presume they were. that's a very good question. I'm gonna presume that they didn't violate any rules when they actually were asked to join the group. Maybe they asked Robert, hey, can you add me to the group so I can respond to it? But it was actually, they said, well, you know, here's our thinking. This is something we've never heard from Facebook before. Here's why we implemented it this way. And they said, we think it's kind of like an email list or email. You don't ask to be added to email. You just, you know, you get an email, an email thread, and somebody adds you to the thread, you CC'd, and then you're part of that thread. I'm not sure I agree with their logic, but what I found interesting was that they had thought about this quite a bit and tried to figure out what's the best way to implement it. And you can imagine how difficult it is to implement something like this.
I don't want to just jump into a new topic.
Go ahead. We're done with this one. New topic.
Adobe Microsoft. Anybody have any thoughts on this?
I think it's bogus. Tom, you covered this when it was breaking news that Microsoft might be acquiring Adobe. They have been meeting with Adobe.
Yeah, well, that's the actual story is that Steve Ballmer and the CEO of Adobe had a closed-door meeting. It's reported that they talked about ways of partnering, and then somebody somewhere speculated that maybe they talked about buying, because, well, there's one way of partnering is Microsoft buys Adobe, and then it just all went off from there.
My understanding of the story was Ballmer made some allusion to it.
I never saw a quote. And maybe I missed it, but I never saw...
Well, first of all, this would be a huge purchase. I mean, how much is Adobe worth? I mean, we're talking a big, big purchase. Not that Microsoft couldn't do it.
Not as much as Yahoo. $20 billion.
$20 billion.
Yeah, so it's not an easy acquisition, especially from a company that hasn't acquired publicly any company this year. They've done like some small acquisitions that they haven't made a big deal about, but there hasn't been anything newsworthy that they've acquired all year long. Well, maybe they're saving up for Adobe. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, the reason for that, Tom, is because they're still wiping their brow saying, wow, we just dodged a bullet with that Yahoo.
We almost bought Yahoo!
They woke up with their hangover and were like, what did I almost bought Yahoo last night.
Yeah, no kidding.
I think it would be a good thing, actually, if Microsoft bought Adobe, because it would concentrate all the really bad security vulnerabilities in one company.
That's what we need to do. It would sure help users. It'd be bad for Apple, though. It'd be really quite a challenge to Apple, because Adobe publishes between Adobe and Microsoft, probably 3/4 of the Apple software marketplace between Office.
But it brings
Photoshop.
Us to the real point here, which is Microsoft trying to shove Phone 7 down everyone's throat. Anybody have any thoughts on where that's headed?
We're going to cover. We've decided to cover, and even though I have to get up very early in the morning to do it because it's 6:30.
In New York?
Yeah, it's 6:30 Pacific time, 9:30 Eastern tomorrow morning. Microsoft will stream this live. Tom, you want to come in early? You don't have to. I'll be sitting here in my jammies.
Microsoft, let me get this straight, Leo. Microsoft's going to be streaming it live to the West Coast at 6:30 in the morning. This is their idea of good marketing,
they
right?
They hadn't really thought about it. They said, well, it's 9:30 in New York. They hadn't really thought about it, obviously.
It's a Seattle company. People that even work at Microsoft won't be seeing it.
Well, I mean, yeah. It does seem odd. But we'll be here. I'll turn on the cameras. We'll stream. I may not look too clean shaven, but we'll stream it live, and I'll do what we do traditionally with this kind of breaking news, which is commentary. Paul Thurrott will be there, and so we will get him on after the event and ask his opinion. He's written the book on Windows Phone 7. John, everybody I know who's seen Windows Phone 7 kind of likes it.
You know, I believe it's probably a good product, but that doesn't mean anything.
It's too late? Is that what you're saying?
It's too little, too late. It's still probably not going to have the display the Apple has, and you know they're so far behind on the curve. Even though they invented the entire market, which is the irony here, they're so far behind on the curve with the new paradigm for these things that I don't see how they can catch up. And I think it's already too late.
You know,
I think they're locked out.
You know who really doesn't like Microsoft right now? The folks who do Angry Birds, Rovio Mobile, which is a Finnish company, observed in Microsoft online ad copy where they were showing icons for apps, the Angry Birds icon. Rovio said, hey, they didn't ask our permission. We aren't currently developing for Windows Phone 7. We don't know if we will develop for Windows Phone 7. We think it's foul play to show the Angry Birds icon in an ad for Windows Phone 7. I'd kind of agree. This is the hottest app on iPhone, on iPad, and now on Android. And this is obviously Microsoft saying, hey, we got that too. But they don't. They tweeted, they are not presently committed to bringing the game to Windows Phone. And the icon is being used in Microsoft marketing completely without permission. Oops.
Well, there you have it.
Oops.
In a nutshell.
That's a good way to piss off the number one developer for games. Microsoft sent a note to Engadget saying, it appears information was mistakenly posted to Microsoft's website and has been removed. And, of course, the offending logo is now gone. But thanks to Engadget, we have a screen capture that will live forever.
Microsoft do that out of arrogance, you think? Just,
yeah.
They won't care. They'll love the free publicity.
Very common to Microsoft, yes.
They probably assumed, hey, we're going to be a huge platform. Of course they're going to develop for us.
Well, there is a story that goes along with that, if you want to hear it.
Yes, I do.
So when we licensed PC Magazine to Brazil for the first time, I went down there and hung out with the guy who was the publisher, who apparently was a world-class surfboard, that whatever you do when you have this surfboard, you're, I don't know, anyway.
Surfer, point, we call it. You mean windsurfer?
Yeah, windsurfer, world-class.
Yeah.
So anyway, he brings up the story about Microsoft because he's getting advertisements for the first few issues, and the Microsoft guy comes in and he says, here's the ads I want to put in. I want this ad, and this ad I want on page 4. I want And so the guy says, okay, well, this is going to cost. No, we're not going to pay for these ads. And he says, what do you mean you're not going to pay for these ads? He says, no, you have to put these ads in because no one's going to think you're a credible magazine unless you have Microsoft ads in your magazine.
Fair try. Did he do it?
No, he told them to screw themselves and slam the door on him.
And did people believe that he was a credible magazine without Microsoft
ads? He stuck around for a number of years, and then now he's done.
I would be incensed by such arrogance.
He was incensed. That's why he told me the story, knowing I'd repeat it.
Yeah, I mean that is fairly arrogant. Although it's a reasonable try.
Yeah, but I guess anyone could give it a shot.
He gave it a shot. It didn't pan out, but you know, you can't fault him for.
You can't fault the guys for trying.
Hey, give us a free ad. you don't ask.
Need it.
Yeah, like they need it. You don't ask, you don't get. Right? It's just that simple. This was a crazy day on Wednesday. So Google TV announcement from Logitech, Facebook announces groups and this download thing, and then Cisco, same day, same time, and all of this, by the way, happening in San Francisco, has a press conference announcing Yumi, perhaps the worst name I've ever heard.
It's not even UME, right? It's UMI.
UMI. So everybody's saying Umi, Uma.
Umi.
Umi.
Oprah.
Oprah, well, if you look at the advertising...
Isn't this some sort of fish roe that's kind of gooey?
Yeah, who said that sounded like it's a bad sushi? I think Molly Wood. It's got one of those bars over the U, so you know you're pronouncing that long, so that's U.
Well, yeah, all Americans know that.
Well, they do because of Motley Crue.
Right, Crue. No, it's not an umlaut, it's a...
Well, it's not an umlaut. It's a long...
Oh, and, you know, they neglected to tell us how to pronounce the I. So, really, they've left it up to us, whether it's you, me, you, my. Could be either.
I'd say umi, looking at that.
I would say umi.
Well, you'd be wrong. See, that long bar over the U means it's a long U. It's you,
me. In grammar school, I was taught that means
Y-O-U.
You were taught that means ooh?
Yeah, and then a smiley face above it means
That's a short U is the smiley face, and the bar is a long U.
Which is ooh.
Is ooh?
Yeah.
Long U is ooh?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it is. I think Tom's right.
Well, then they're really screwed up.
I would pronounce it umi.
Okay, let me ask the chat room. Are there any English teachers, sixth or fifth grade English teachers in the chat room?
We have a native English speaker. We should ask him.
Are there any native English speakers... in the chat
what
room.
I'd say is $599 for a video conferencing thing seems like a lot of money.
I guess we really won't have to learn the name at all.
Why don't we change the name to UJIP?
Not only is it $599 to buy it, but you pay $30 a month to use it.
Oh, that's no good.
$26 a month to use
Can't
it.
Can't you use Skype for free?
Yes.
And it works on a computer. Right, you don't need this device.
I think it sounds like they woke up in sort of 1985 and thought, wow, video conferencing is going to be the thing of the future, and they didn't realize it had already been done.
Whoops. Well,
there's this mistaken belief, and this is in the Skype TV as well, that you want to use your television for calling people because your television has video on it. So isn't that great? I'm going to call grandma on my TV.
No, you're not. That's
not.
Wait, Tom? Do you remember when there was a series, Leo, you probably remember this, there was a bunch of televisions that were brought out in the 70s that you'd run your phone through, and when the phone would ring, it would interrupt the TV show, and you'd talk, you didn't
just
have video, but
want.
You would talk over the TV. It was ridiculous.
Yeah, it's like caller ID on your direct TV.
Yeah, I remember that, yeah.
And now the murderer is ring.
Ring, ring. Hi, honey, are you doing anything?
That was before DVRs, when you couldn't even rewind.
Now, you can't call a Yumi from your PC. We've actually bought a Yumi and ordered it. Well, just because we thought, well, maybe if it's like, maybe it's so good. Oh, great. This is what everybody wants to watch. You doing a limbo party.
Flying boxes.
And then, never miss a thing. Well, I didn't miss that. That's
Cisco has got their heads up their ass when it comes to marketing. Their latest thing, what's the name of that girl who was in Juno? The actress.
Oh, those are the worst ads I've ever seen. Ellen Page.
All this says to me is there's somebody in the marketing department who's got a crush on Ellen Page.
Yeah.
And so they hired her to do these ads. It's idiotic.
They're terrible ads. Let's just watch one. I just knocked down everything. Let's just watch one just so you get an idea of how awful these ads are. This is Ellen Page.
Well, look who's here. It's Ellen.
Hey, Mayor Wade. How you doing?
Great. Come on here. Would you like to see our new police department? Yeah, all right.
Get this way. Here it is.
Completely networked.
So anything happening, Suze?
She's all good.
That's great. My local police are watching me.
Spying
on me with a Cisco system, and they're showing Ellen Page how it works. Come on in, Ellen.
You're right, exactly. And look at, here's Leo's bedroom. And
the new community. See it? Live it.
That's not the new community. What the hell?
Cisco.
What the hell? I don't want that. By the way, who is that ad for? Is it for police departments?
I'm glad I'm an Omega. I'd hate to be an Alpha.
What?
So in Britain, we've got, you know, CCTV cameras everywhere. And in fact, there's a plan that's being talked about where the actual citizens can watch the CCTV cameras and report crimes and get cash rewards.
Oh,
so, great. You know, we're on the, you know, if you want the bleeding edge of the Big Brother state, come to Britain.
Cash awards. Let me just check, by the way, and
cash
see.
Cash awards.
277 people have now pledged to Babbage. We only need 49,723 more. Please, please give generously. Give generously.
Give till
it's
it
like
helps.
The countdown to Bernie Madoff being let go.
I don't know what happened. I've lost control of the switcher. I can't get rid of this picture. Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. I don't know what's happened. I've pushed a button. You're just going to have
you
to watch this.
You pushed the wrong button.
The tote board.
I can't. We're stuck on that page.
Timpani.
I can't do anything.
It's a special page that sticks you.
I don't know what I did.
That's right. You need to put more coal.
Oh, there it is. Oh, thank goodness. Oh,
here I am.
Oh, that was painful. I don't know. I clicked a button. Well, now I know. Now I know what that button does.
Don't. Oh, you just pushed a random button just to see what it does?
No, I accidentally clicked it. Whatever you do, do not push that button.
Okay, what do you got there, Leo, that you hung there? You didn't hang it there for not to get some attention. What
no,
is it?
No, it's just we had a visitor from Kuala Lumpur, KL as he calls it. He's wanted you to go to Kuala Lumpur for some time, and you refused. So he gave me this little handicraft wood placard that says—
I refused what?
Twit. Well, he told me that he couldn't get you to KL.
I've been to KL.
Oh, there you go.
I'd go back in a minute. It's a fantastic place.
Daniel, he'd go back in a minute.
I would.
He's the host of This Week in Asia, which is not an affiliate of the Twit Network.
Is that one of your shows?
No, I don't know anything about it. But see, I don't mind if Daniel does that show. I think it's a good thing. Let's see here. North Korea, as long as we're in Asia, opens up the internet for a national anniversary. Isn't that nice of them? North Korea appears to have made its first full connection to the internet. The connection planning for which has been going on.
Is this a Steam connection?
For at least 9 months. It took them 9 months. Came as the reclusive country prepares to mark the 65th anniversary of the founding of the ruling Workers' Party of Korea with a massive celebration and military parade.
An analytical engine is powering the internet.
They have a total of, get this, 1,024 internet addresses. They've been reserved for North Korea but never used. What is that, a Class G?
I think it's NK.
I've got more addresses on my Cisco router. other North Korea-linked websites operate from locations outside the country via direct connections to the China internet. But now the North Korean IT guys really know their stuff, says Melissa Chan, a correspondent for Al Jazeera. We have access to Facebook, Twitter, and here I am able to Skype with you. This press release reads like, this is from Computer World, but it reads like it was written by Kim Il-un. Or whatever his name is, the new guy.
Yeah, Kim Il-un.
Kim Jong-un something.
Kim Jong-un.
Kim Jong-il is the current.
Right, and his son is
the dad. His
Kim
third
Jung,
son has been named.
Unbelievable. As
Kim Jong-un.
Unbelievable.
Or close to that.
Didn't that happen in the U.S. where the third son got named to be president? I could have sworn there were two.
We did the same thing, didn't we?
Yeah, they're just imitating us.
Yeah, as long as Jeb Bush doesn't get in,
Well, actually, this is an interesting thing about Korea, and then we'll get back to tech, is that Kim Jong-il's father is actually still the leader of the government, even though he's dead.
Ah. They just don't
want to go. That sounds like a good way to go.
Yeah.
I think dead politicians running things is the way to go.
Oh,
can't
you know,
go wrong. Can't make any mistakes.
Can't nullify them. According to Reuters, Hulu is planning an IPO that may raise as much as $300 million. Would you buy stock in Hulu today?
Yes.
John?
Probably not.
John, too. I don't know what John Graham coming.
John is talking to.
Well, so I can't contact him from here because they just say to you, you're not in the U.S., so you can't watch anything. Go away.
So I'll
buy stock, too. So they've got $10 so far, Tom.
Well, we can't. I can't because I'm cover technology, so I won't buy it. But if I could, I probably would.
I wouldn't, actually. I don't know if I'd buy stock in them. I don't know.
I'd short it then.
Short it. Well, I don't know if I'd short it either. It's one of those things where who knows what's going to happen. Don't you think
I think... You know what? I am putting my faith in Hulu's leadership, not in their backers.
Yes, that's the problem.
The guys who run Hulu actually know what they need to do, and they're just chipping away at the folks who are actually backing them, trying to get them to cooperate and do it.
Exactly. Which is why I think it's a bad idea to put any money in them.
No, oh, maybe you're right.
If they were all united.
They're not. Never will be. Too many... old farts in the industry.
Yeah.
Suits. You know what I'm talking about, Leo?
I wear a suit.
Talking about your Hawaiian shirts.
That's it. Look at my suit now. No Hawaiian here. They beat me down. So once again, tomorrow morning, 6:30 in the morning, I can't believe I've committed to this. I'm going to be turning on the cameras. We'll do live coverage at 6:30 in Pacific, 9:30 Eastern time of the Windows Phone 7 launch out of New York City with Microsoft. Paul Thurrott will co-anchor in New York City. Wednesday, Tom and I will be interviewing the Woz, the founder of Apple Computer, co-founder of Apple Computer. That'll be 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern. And, of course, don't forget to watch Tom's show Monday through Friday, Tech News Today. That's a start. They kind of the pre-shows at 2:30 Pacific, 5:30 Eastern, and then they get underway really by 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern time. And, of course, you can subscribe and should subscribe to either the audio or the video or both if you should choose at twit.tv/TN. Thomas, great to have you on the show. Thank you for taking some time off your day off.
Yeah, no, it's great. Twit is the perfect complement to Tech News Today because what we do every day is say, these are the stories that broke. Here's why they're important today. Here's some stuff you need to know. Here's what you guys are saying about it. And we're out. Whereas Twit, you get to analyze it a little more and kind of put it in context. Talk about what it means.
We chew it and we chew it till it's softened in our cud.
Yeah. It's like the saliva for Tech News.
Exactly. Think of us as the second stomach. You're the first stomach.
Tech News Today is the teeth to Twit's saliva.
And then the stomach. And by the way, you're going to stick around because coming up East Meets West in just a few minutes with Roger Chang. All right. John C. Dvorak is the host of No Agenda.
And by the way, Leo, I'm telling you right now, Twit is the perfect complement to No Agenda.
And why
is
that,
John? It's the saliva for political chat.
We are the sputum that spews forth from the mouth of No Agenda. Or something.
Sputum?
Sputum. Sputum.
ChannelDvorak.com. Check it out.
There it is. And don't forget to contribute to No Agenda because God knows they need your money. How much to be an executive producer? $200, huh?
Yeah, and you get an actual credit.
Wouldn't it be funny if I were the executive producer of No Agenda?
$200
That'd actually be worth.
Actually, you
got
to hit 333 to get. Yeah, that's associate executive producers. 333 and up, you get the executive producer spot.
How many executive producers are there
on any given show? Like this last show, we had probably 4 executive producers and 3 associates.
Wow, that ain't bad.
What the hell? Wait a minute. Let me do some quick math. You're making thousands of dollars an episode.
You had 4 paid executive
grand, maybe
producers?
An episode, enough to get by, enough to pay a couple of bills. We don't make the kind of money you're making, Leo.
Wait a minute. You're saying that 4 people paid $333 to be just for that?
Actually, more than that. That's the minimum.
They're allowed to pay more?
we have supporters.
Wow.
And they pay us to be on the air. Unlike, you know, people that use advertisers.
I clearly have missed the boat here somewhere.
No. You believe me, you did not miss the boat.
Wow. Well, anyway, John is at channeldvorak.com. Give him $333.33. Wow.
You're flabbergasted.
I am stunned.
What you're implying is that why would anybody?
That's exactly what I'm saying.
A nickel.
We asked for $2. $333, and that only gets you one show, right? You're not like the associate producer forever.
No. You get this show. You'd be the executive producer of that show. That's the way the executive producer business is.
I would have to give you $333.33 every episode to be the executive producer of that episode forever.
Yeah, that's fine. You can afford it. It's well within your pocketbook.
And Jason Calacanis thought this weekend was a good idea.
Well, there you have it.
John Graham Cumming is the author of The Geek Atlas. And please help him. Go to pledgebank.com and help him raise some money to build the Babbage analytical engine. We want to see it. We want to touch it. We want to hear its thrumming motors, its giant steam engine, its 1.73 kilobytes of memory. Great to have you on again, John. Thanks for staying up late with us.
Thank you very much. I think I'm going to go to bed now.
Yeah. Night night.
It's late.
Night night.
It's 1 o'clock in the morning.
Pledgebank.com/Babbage. Give them $333.33. It's really neat. Hey, thank you all for being here. We do Twit every Sunday afternoon at 3 p.m. Pacific. 2200 UTC, 6 p.m. Eastern time at live.twit.tv. You can watch live. You can join us in the chat room. Always a lot of fun in there. Crazy, crazy people. If you want to join us in the chat room, just go to irc.twit.tv during the broadcast. You too could be part of the fun at no charge, no cost to you. No operators will call. I'm Leo Laporte. Thanks for being here. See you next week. Another Twit.
This is amazing.